Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. You're tuned in to Columbo Chronicles at Blog Talk Radio. Follow the mover and shaker, award-winning author and host, seen on TV and radio, Rose Columbo. Every Wednesday, Rose interviews prominent experts and authors on politics and social justice. Call in and listen or ask the guest the question at 646-564-9742. Now, here's Rose.
Hi, everyone. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo, and I'm your host on Columbo Chronicles Live. I'm here for you every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast of the good old USA. Check the time in your area or country and follow me and share with your social media, family, and friends. I'm checking to see which countries tuned in the last 7 days, and I want to welcome you and thank you for listening to Columbo Chronicle Live at Blog Talk Radio. The shows are archived, and you can return at any time to listen to past shows with your favorite topics, favorite guests, who are the experts, authors, experts, and you just have to Google blogtalkradio.com/Columbo Chronicles. Scroll down and listen to your favorite guest and topic, which could be from romance to corruption to the Constitution, child abuse, divorce, animal rights, health, science fiction. Could be almost anything of interest to most of us. And many of these topics affect our very lives. You can listen live at 646-564-9742 on your phone, or you can also listen live online every Wednesday evening. You just need to check the time in your area and your country. Tonight we have a returning guest, and he has an extensive background, and I'll be telling you about his background in just a few minutes. He's written an intriguing science fiction book entitled 30th Century Escape, and he's turning his work into a trilogy. In fact, he's an inventor, and he's going to talk to us about inventions, ideas, concepts, patents. So get out a pen and a paper and get ready. If you have an idea, a concept, an invention, and you want to know how to get started, how to get it patented, now is your opportunity to take notes from the expert. Well, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and we know there's a lot of turkeys in D.C. and around the world, and many of them will probably be pardoned for their sins, no doubt, as they continue to expose, well, maybe that's the wrong word, to reveal their sins before Thanksgiving. They just keep coming out of the woodwork. Anyway, this sexual harassment theme that is spreading like wildfire, and apparently, I don't know where all these women came from 20, 30, 40 years ago and where they were 20, 30, 40 years ago without telling anyone about their allegations until now, election year of 2018 coming up, as well as 2020. All very strange, very odd, although I am not downplaying sexual harassment. I think every female has been sexually harassed at some time in their life, but most of us just move on unless it's a very serious allegation, and of course be allowed to happen to any female, any child, any teenager, and if true, they must be held accountable. We need to get back to morals. We need to get back to principles, values, integrity, truth, and we need to start electing people of good character. Unfortunately, for the past 40-plus years, we've elected many people who are not of good character, but are just character and playing a part. They're actors, and many are funneling taxpayer money, making deals with Big Pharma for campaign donations, inappropriate sexual encounters, flights on Alita Express over to Orgy Island to party with a serious registered pedophile, which is right there and tells you who's guilty and who's not guilty. Hello. I mean, who does that? And, of course, there's the International Pedophile Ring, started with the Franklin cover-up. I did interview Senator John DeCamp. He did say a lot of things in the interview that I did not air, and then the videos got went missing. But it doesn't mean that that information isn't in the book or the names, because it is, but it's very difficult to read because the allegations are so serious against minor children who are kidnapped and used as sex slaves and drug couriers. So we really need to clean up our country. I mean, seriously, for the sake of the children and future generations and all the future natural-born Americans, millions who are being wiped out by abortion scissors, which is a heinous crime, in my opinion, to stab a baby in the head with abortion scissors to kill them, crush their little heads, and rip their body parts off, and sell their body parts and their organs for profit. And it almost appears as if it's a blood sacrifice and very dark, and a depopulation program of natural-born Americans. We have wiped out 70 million future Americans who would be with us today, but are not, because they were wiped out before they took their first breath. And then we have over 100,000 children missing per year. So sex trafficking, human trafficking, is very serious, and women need to be careful going out at night. They need to be careful in parking lots, and they shouldn't be walking alone at night, even if they're just going to the market, because sex trafficking, human trafficking, is a multi-billion dollar business. And thanks to the past presidents, vice presidents, Congress, and senators, our borders remain open and unsecure, and we just let anybody into our country. Unidentified, running for public office, working for TSA, working along the borders, getting security jobs. So how secure do you feel? So these are issues we need to be concerned about, because we are responsible for restoring the Constitution and sovereignty. We are responsible for the lives of every unborn baby, for the lives of every born baby. We are responsible for the future of this great country, that they live in a safe country, not just a great country, but a safe country, because those public servants swore to uphold the Constitution and sovereignty, and they swore to protect the safety and welfare and health and lives of every American, and that's why we taxpayer fund them for life. So we really need to look at what we're doing. We're paying people, taxpayer funding people, for the rest of their lives who haven't performed their fiduciary duty to uphold, defend, protect, and preserve the Constitution of the United States of America, legal immigration, legal citizenship, proper vetting of presidents and proper vetting of politicians and proper vetting of foreigners coming into our country. And this is a serious problem if we are going to preserve and maintain a nation that is free, that protects liberty and freedom, not only for ourselves, because we created this mess, but mainly for our children, grandchildren, and future generations, so that they, too, can live in a safe America, not just a great America, but a safe America. And that's very, very important. So, on that note, I'm going to take a break because, you know, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and I do want to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone in America and anyone celebrating around the world and giving thanks for food and for family, and especially the Native American Indians. I want to say thank you and God bless you. And it's also a very special day for our military. I want to thank them, our firefighters, and all the medical professionals who work 24/7 around the clock, and paramedics and police and so forth. Sometimes they don't get to have the day off. So remember that we need to give thanks for our land, our homeland, the rain, the sunlight, the soil, the seeds that we grow for our food, our farmers, our ranchers, our family, our friends, the clean water, jobs, a roof over our heads. See how blessed we are. It's these little things in life that most of us take for granted and forget to give thanks to God or a higher power, whichever you prefer, as some like to say. So from my home and Colombo Chronicles, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving, a blessed Thanksgiving day, no matter where you are around the world or in the great and safe USA. And I also want to wish a very happy Thanksgiving and a blessed Thanksgiving to President Trump and his family and all our legislators. And I hope that they will get themselves straightened out and get back on track and remember who we are and how exceptional we are and why they were elected. So I'll take a break, and I'll be back in just a moment. So don't touch that dial.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Colombo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Colombo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to ColomboChronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Colombo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColomboChronicles.com.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up to Colombo Chronicles Live. And let's just get a little rundown here of what has been going on around the country. Well, ISIS releases a detailed plan for Barron Trump's assassination. This is out of control. And this is totally unacceptable. And the FBI and law enforcement need to start vetting these people that have come into our country, and they need to start deporting them, period. This is very, very serious, and it is not acceptable at all. It's just disgusting. Steve Bannon, information is going to come out showing GOP establishment is behind Roy Moore, Judge Roy Moore, sabotage campaign. Well, here we have a judge, and he's running for public office. He happens to be a conservative, and he happened to save the Ten Commandments from being stripped off the courthouse walls. And he is under attack, and Gloria Allred is part of that agenda. And she also did the same to Herman Cain and President Trump when they were candidates, and to the female who was running against Governor Brown, who's a Democrat, in California. So this is sort of a pattern of what she does. And it says that Gloria Allred crashes and burns, refuses four times to say whether the yearbook was a forgery, so the tide is turning against the Roy Moore accuser. So, you know, the reason I was talking about that is because in America, what makes us exceptional is the Constitution of the United States of America and sovereignty and due process of law. Due process of law is what makes us exceptional. We have Miranda rights. We have the right to a lawyer, a phone call, a jury, a trial, a judge, as natural-born Americans and even legal naturalized Americans. And we have a right to be to defend ourselves in a court of law, and we are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And here you have a judge who the rhinos and the left is saying is guilty until proven innocent. And I think that's very sad in our country, that he's being judged by mob rule and by the media and even by some congressional members who don't have any evidence to prove their allegation against him. So sometimes we just have to take a step back and remember that mob rule doesn't work in a civilized nation. If you want to read about Uranium One, I actually exposed it in 2015, nearly 3 years ago. I have a blog. It's Rose for Justice. That's the number four, roseforjustice.com. It's also posted on my wall on Facebook. It's entitled The Clinton Dynasty, Obama, Jared, Russia, China, Iran, Uranium, Water, Oil, Pipelines, and Donations versus Ethics, Government Property, Conflicts, and Self-Gain. So you may want to take a look at that, and it could be a good read for you before you go to sleep and give you some food for thought. So on that note, let's take a little break, and we'll come back and we'll talk to our guest, our very special dynamic guest tonight, and I will tell you all about him as soon as we come back from this important message. So don't touch that dial.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but Some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Yes, listen up, because now we have a very intriguing returning guest, and his name is Dr. Mark Kingston Levin, and he's an internationally known scientist, an author, and an award-winning author. And his book is entitled 30th Century Escape, which won an Irwin Award from the Book Publicists of Southern California for the best science fiction book of the year. He has many, many talents. He's not just a famous scientist. He's a successful inventor. And Dr. Levin was born and grew up in Vermont with many winters spent in Florida as a child. And as a teenager, he wrote poetry, he served as a lifeguard, and played football. He currently enjoys sailing, exploring underwater caves, snorkeling, writing science fiction, and other pursuits. After working on the Apollo and Mars projects, he decided to return to school to study under Nobel laureate Paul Dirac, obtaining his PhD in only 2.5 years. Dr. Levin founded 2 companies and served as a science advisor to President Ford. He has published over 44 times in the scientific literature, and he was awarded over 32 U.S. patents. As a science fiction writer, he is now emerging from his first work, a trilogy entitled 30th Century Escape. So let's not waste any time, and let's say hello to Dr. Mark Kingston Levin. Hi, Mark. How are you this evening?
I'm doing just fine, Rose. Look forward to talking to you more about inventions and other things.
Perfect. Well, before we start in on the inventions, why don't you tell our audience who missed the show about 30th Century Escape a little bit about your award-winning book?
Well, it's about a woman, young woman, maybe in her 40s. She's from the future and from the 30th century, and she escapes back to the 21st century. And she has to adjust and keep her life a secret because she can't let out the time travel secret. She was able to escape with a time machine, but she was cornered and had only one escape route, and that was it. But she did escape, and she was able to send her team to the 27th century, which was the major mission, but she went to the 21st century for some reason that she, at the time, didn't understand. But she comes to our time, and she is isolated on an island that was used for nuclear testing in the South Pacific. It was the French island of Mururoa, and she has to survive there, and she does. And she is finally rescued 4 months, a little bit late, 4 months plus maybe a few days later. And she has to then adjust. Initially, the language is different because languages evolve, and the 30th century English is just totally different than our language today. And she has to adapt and learn the language. And so she plays mute or feigns mute and is finally able to learn the language, which she had studied some when she was actually a historian who studied the 21st century. So she had kind of a inkling of what goes on there, and she kind of loved that, and she also got a PhD in archaeology. In the 30th century, people generally get more than one PhD because they have much longer lives. And in my vision of the future, these people in the 30th century are going to live for about 800 years, which is about 10 times what we live today, which is close to 80 years. So this is going to be a big change, and education will be very different. And also people will get smarter and the brain cavity will grow, and we'll see increases in brain weight and other things. And in my future, it's going to be, in the end, a pretty good ride. But in the end, of the first book is 30th Century Escape. Actually, the whole book is called, the trilogy itself is called 30th Century. So each book has a word with it. And the first book is Escape, and that's the one that won the award. The second book is not out yet. It's written, but I'm still getting some artwork illustrations and those things done. Hopefully it will be out by the end of the year. Latest will be January. And then there's a third book that's also written and will also come out after the artwork for that one is done, maybe by April or March. But that's roughly what's going on. And the exciting things that happen in she goes to college, gets a PhD in our time, and she writes a PhD about dark energy, which is one of the topics of today. And so she addresses that with real science, and it's new science, I should call it. But anyway, it's another approach to a solution. It's only a hypothesis, basically. And that hypothesis is really about black holes making space. And that's the reason the universe is expanding, because recently more and more black holes, as the stars from the beginning of the universe start to burn out, we get more and more black holes. So we have billions of black holes in our universe today, and the rate of formation is increasing. But eventually it will decrease. And black holes live for a very long time, trillions of years. So eventually there'll only be black holes, our universe. And if we go into the trillions of years in the future, a few trillion years, we'll still have some red dwarfs and other the stars, but neutron stars and other things also live for a fair amount of time. But eventually we'll only have black holes. And at that time, in my theory, gravity takes over, and eventually what I think happens is that we get a very, very big, like each one of the galaxies have a supermassive black hole, million times the mass of our sun or more. And eventually when you get to a certain size, a black hole turns into a white hole, which is another Big Bang. So that's probably how the first Big Bang happened, or the first one we know about, but there may have been many more before, and there may be many more after. We don't know for sure all about that, but that's a little bit about what goes on in chapter 20. So just to give a slight idea of, there is some science to it. There's a lot of fiction, and a lot of characters. There's one character she falls in love with, and his name is Marty. He's a professor of marine biology, and she eventually marries him. So in the end of the book, she doesn't go back to the 30th century, even though she has the opportunity. She stays with her husband. So just to give you a little bit about what goes on. But, yeah.
Thank you so much. That's so intriguing. I mean, it just makes you want to just read more and more about it, because it's like trying to imagine going into that time frame, and living 800 years. It's like a long, long time, because in the Bible, it says people live 400 years, which is hard to imagine. 800 years,
well,
I really like that.
new genetic engineering and new studies of cells and lots of things will lead to increased lifespan. We've already increased the lifespan of certain insects a factor of 10.
My goodness.
There's, so, you know, and there's more than one way to do it.
I know you love inventions because you've invented many, many inventions. Let's see. So how did you come up with getting involved with inventions? And was it just one concept and all of a sudden it developed into more and more? How did you – what was the reason that you got involved?
It all started when I was a – Yeah, it all started when I was a PhD student in Miami, and I was going over to the Bahamas to do diving in these blue holes caves to try to date these stalagmites and stalactites that were found. And I rode with a guy, and I got talking to him, and his name was Bill Keelhorn. And he, World War II, was a fighter pilot, and he was interested in doing airplane work, you know, airplane oceanography. He had a contract he was going to put out in what's called Business Commerce Daily, and he told me about it. So even though I was a student, I decided I was going to send in a proposal. And I wrote a proposal, and I won one of the contracts for the small business that were, they set, had certain set-asides for small business in those days. And they still do, but they do it a different way. And so I got a contract, and it was a lucrative contract that was for trying to measure sound velocity in the ocean. And it became very important in 1967 when the Japanese sold the Russians certain type of turbines, which they used in their submarines. And the Russian submarines suddenly became quiet, and we could no longer find them. So it became very important. Once you have the sound velocity, you can put it into Wilson's equation. Once you have certain parameters you measure in the ocean, like you sense temperature and the conductivity and those things, and then you can calculate the sound velocity, and then you can make the things more accurate, and you can find the Russian submarine. So it became an important factor. So I worked on that, and that was got funded. And I went to B.B. Rebozo, who had a bank of Key Biscayne on Key Biscayne Island, which is right near Miami, kind of across from where Coral Gables is. I got a what's called an SBA loan for $800,000 and got started. So that's how it happened. And then I just applied for more contracts that I saw in the Business Commerce Daily, and people wanted sensors at that time, and they wanted to detect submarines under the ice, and they wanted to detect also the Coast Guard, which was very simple devices. They wanted to measure the currents in transport in the Gulf of Mexico. And also I had University of Miami and Nova School of Oceanography that wanted to measure transport in the Gulf Stream. And one thing very interesting about the Gulf Stream that a lot of average people don't know is that there's cold water down at the bottom and it's moving south, and the warm water is moving north, and that's how the Earth becomes more balanced in temperature between the poles. And and sometimes in the past it's been quite a bit hotter in the poles, so there was better transport than there is today. But we don't know exactly what happened, but we know there had to be a better transport because there's tropical things in the poles fossils that we find evidence of quite warm temperatures. So at some time it was quite different, but you study the geology and the physics and the chemistry and the biology, and you put it all together, and you can kind of go back, say, 600 million years when the Earth was like a snowball, froze up completely. It was much warmer before that, but there was life, actually life, bacteria, simple life, for billions of years. And then after the snowball, what happened, the Earth's dynamic heat engine blew a lot of volcanoes and put a lot of carbon dioxide in the air, which everybody's worried about today. But in those days, it took the frozen Earth, was even frozen in the equators, and melted it, and life returned and exploded in what's known 500 million years ago as the Cambrian explosion. So that's when all the hard shell life and other life and fossils that we find today. Even I found some in the San Diego area, but in Utah and Nevada, and in those areas there are just huge amounts of fossils. And so this kind of proved a point that the life, and then of course the dinosaurs were very successful, and then they died out, and that's supposed to be caused by an asteroid that hit. But on to inventions. I invented it for economic reasons, because I needed, first of all, to do research to develop products. And the military at that time, particularly ARPA, and it used to be called DARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agencies, and then it became called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And I did a lot of work for them. I did a lot of work for the Navy. Probably the biggest customer was the Navy, because they wanted a lot of these different types of sound velocity things. That was a big issue in those days. And sound velocity changes, so you have to measure it over and over again many times, you know, two or three times a year at least, and it's a disposable product. So every time they use it, they have to make a new one. And they throw it out of the airplane with a shotgun shell, and it goes down with a parachute or a rotor chute. There were two types. And when it gets to the water, hits the water, it activates the battery, and the power comes on, and then the probe releases. So it was really economic reasons. Plus, I was just getting my PhD, and I wanted opportunity to go into business. I thought it'd be a really good thing. I liked airplanes, and way I could only afford to fly them is I got the government to pay for them, because the ones I liked were like amphibious aircraft that I could land in the ocean. And I was really fascinated with those airplanes. So I found a way, you know, to make it happen.
So what was your favorite invention, and which one did you have the most fun with?
Well, the one I made the most money on was the anti-submarine warfare detection device for sound velocity. But there were some, the transport ones I did for the Coast Guard, those were beautiful. And there was one for detecting submarines under the ice, which is still, a lot of it is classified, but basically you use something similar to magnetic imagery. And the device is called quadrupole magnetic resonance. And so you measure magnetic resonance, but you have to put a pulse, very short pulse of electromagnetic energy through the ice that will penetrate the ice, and it will interact with the metal, heavy metals. In fact, today they use this technology for finding gold. So it can work on land, it can work in the ocean, but in the ocean, if you're going to find a lot of ice, the bigger the signal, you get closer and closer to the submarine. So it's very easy to once you've got the technology developed, but you have to operate this thing, at least in my day. I'm sure they've improved it since my time. But we were using liquid helium to cool the niobium tin coil. There was a coil of niobium tin. It's an alloy that's a superconductor at about 20 degrees Kelvin, and liquid helium is well below that, about 4 degrees Kelvin. So Kelvin is absolute. There's no temperature at 0 degrees Kelvin, but nobody's reached that temperature yet. Anyway, we get very close to it. But this is it was very interesting. It excited me. I thought it was fun. And, I started myself as a theoretical type of scientist in quantum mechanics, which is still, you know, the area that's responsible for the transistor and the laser and many of the gadgets that we have today, all made possible by quantum theory. And we also have relativity, which Einstein put forth, the theory of gravity, which is phenomenal improvement over what we had before. But the two have never been married, and people are trying to work on a way to combine the quantum theory and the theory of gravity, and which we know from Einstein's work, as you know, he called it relativity, which is a good name for it because it has a lot to do with the relative speeds and sizes of the different things. For example, that's why an astronaut who would go out really far, like interstellar, and get near a black hole, time would go much slower for them. But you'd have to be awfully close to a black hole. It wouldn't quite go as fast as what they showed in the film. But if it took longer, it would be more realistic. But that's a minor detail. I think they did a really good job with Interstellar, but they changed it very much. If you read the book, the movie was a different story. Like with The Martian, the book was just like the movie. It was amazing. They did a fantastic job with it. But, I mean, I don't really want to criticize Interstellar because I think it was a very great opportunity to show the public what relativity is. In other words, if you send somebody there and you bring him back here, he's not going to age as much as we would here. For one, he's traveling at a much higher speed, and then he's in a gravitational field that's much higher. So higher gravitational fields, you age slower. So clocks are not always the same. See, Newton thought clocks were all the same. But Einstein figured out relativity, which is, they're not, and we should give some credit to Lorentz and some of the other physicists who were also working at the time. No one person really, we all are on the back of giants. In other words, without Newton, Einstein couldn't, you know, make a better theory. He first needed to have some theory, and Newton came up with a theory, but it wasn't perfect. But and there was certain orbits like Mercury that were different in the Einstein. I mean, Newton's work didn't agree with what really happened in the world or orbits. And they said, well, that's just an aberration. But when Einstein figured it out with the different theory, and Einstein was the first one that said space is not nothing. It is something. And you can bend and it can flex. And he called it the fabric of time and space. And I think that's very important because I think as we go forward, we'll realize that space is not a vacuum. It is a vacuum compared to some of the other things, but it also consists of something that we can't feel. But don't forget, about 70% of the universe, we cannot see. Like dark matter, which when they found out that the galaxies would fly apart and the orbits would be different of the suns unless there was another matter, and they called that dark matter. So there's a lot of physics. So I got very interested in all these things at the time. It was an exciting time. New things were coming up, and people are always looking for this dark matter. But there's some types of matter that we cannot see, we don't interact with. And like neutrinos, they go right through us and don't cause us any harm. So there's a lot of interesting things when you get to fundamental particles, and they follow the small particles that the Earth is made of, follow pretty much the quantum theory. And therefore, you know, we were able to make these big strides forward in electronics and cell phones and computers. And of course, some days we'll certainly make great strides from now. I think one area will be in artificial intelligence. I've never really worked in that area, although I did work on submersibles, unmanned underwater submersibles. And I also worked on some manned ones way long ago when I was a youngster. In fact, I invented a hydrogen generator to be used because they wanted to extend the range, and they were using batteries, so they went to fuel cells, made a hybrid, which was battery and fuel cell, and they needed a generator to generate hydrogen. They needed one to generate oxygen too, and then these gases would react and form water, and there would be no bubbles, and so this could be used for CIA or other covert operations. And so that was one of the things I started with. So you wanted to talk about some of the inventions. One that I really liked, it was very simple, was to detect tritium. The only thing is, I don't know what exactly where they were going to use it and any of that stuff. They never give me that information. Oh, just a need to know. But basically what I made was something that looked like a weed that you could drop from an airplane, had some weight on the front end of it. It would bury itself in the ground, and they could fly over and interrogate it anytime they wanted to, but they had to have a special code to activate it. And then it would send out a signal, and it measured the amount of tritium. And tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. It's called heavy, heavy hydrogen. So if people have what's called heavy water, like in World War II, that's the way it was planning to build the bomb. And the Norwegians sabotaged and blew up a ferry that contained lots of civilians and children and everything, but they knew it was so important they had to do it. And when it got in the deep part of the lake, they blew it up and it went down, and the heavy water was lost, and Hitler's bomb program was set back tremendously. But anyway, if you take uranium, and you don't need to isotope separate it, in heavy water, it will make plutonium very easily and very purely, and then you can separate the plutonium and make bombs. Therefore, it was our government's interest in detecting tritium, which is made in these heavy water plants and has a vapor pressure and can escape into the atmosphere and then can drift, and then our little thing can detect it. And our thing was like a Vicor glass coated with a certain type of detector that if you hit it with an electron, like a tritium gives off an electron, if you hit it with an electron, it will produce a photon or two, and then the photon will be collected, and by measuring the photons, we'll know how much tritium is there. But any detection of tritium is pretty indicated that somebody is probably building a bomb. That's the way India, for example, built their bomb. They used the heavy water approach. And the Canadians also used heavy water in their power plants, their nuclear power plants. So you can use it for commercial purposes, but you can also use it for weapons purposes. We used some of those heavy water reactors in Georgia, and there's a place called Savannah River, Georgia. There's a plant that produced plutonium using those production type reactors. So we figured that anybody who's going to do it on a commercial scale is probably going to produce a lot of tritium, and it's going to get out. And so I think that was a detector for that purpose. But it was relatively simple, but I didn't make that many. But anyway, I made some. And they seem to be happy with it. But another device that I developed for saving lives so that the Coast Guard could find somebody at night in the water was a multispectral scanner. And, of course, the infrared portion is very important because you at night you can see better infrared object in the water. If somebody is just, swimming or staying afloat or in a life jacket, you can see their head, and that will produce heat. And that additional heat can be seen, say, at, it's called the infrared, but way out to 10 microns. But the particular infrared area is very important for that. But in the daytime, you need other scanners. You need to scan other parts of the spectrum to be able to see things. And one area is if you can see the orange, usually somebody has a life preserver on. Or it's orange. Now, some might be yellow. If the aviation, they use yellow. So depending on what you're looking for, you can you can see the spectra, and it will come back. Different colors will come back, for example. If it's the orange, it will show orange. If it's yellow, it will show yellow. So in the sea, the Coast Guard, most of the ships, they use orange, and the pilots use yellow, and they have yellow boats, little rubber boats. And normally they can deploy one of those. They're not much bigger than a person, and, you know, the person can get in there. And, of course, if he's in the northern part, you're going to die in 20 minutes unless you have one of these little rubber crafts that can get you out of the weather and the wind. And those are available in most aviation. But in the tropics, people can survive for a long time, for days in the water. So those were some of the reasons that I was interested in those things, and of course applied for money. I didn't work on many things during that period of time with my first company unless there was funding for it. But after I sold the first company, then I got interested in developing some technology of my own, and I did fund stuff and develop sensor for carbon monoxide, for example, using some, there were certain bacterias that made this thing I used in my sensor. It was called cyclodextrins. And these compounds were made by a bacteria. And eventually the bacteria had to be manipulated because the one I wanted was only made They made all these different ones. I needed the gamma, and only 0.07% of the bacteria that were around that you could buy made that. So what I wanted is to make all of the 0.07. And turns out we figured it out, finally, that this bacteria was just a very small percent of what the other bacteria was, that each bacteria made a different one. And we were able to get that bacteria isolated and then grow it and make it more concentrated until we were able to, today you can genetically engineer it, but in those days we didn't have the technology to do that. We did it by selection. So we grew it and we got up to 1%, and we got up to 2%, and pretty soon 4%. And then, we kept enhancing it and selecting it. And we got, pretty much up to 50%. We were happy. And I think by the time I was with the company, I retired in 2014 from this business, which I had become CEO of. We sold 31 million of those sensors.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot of sensors.
That's a lot. So, our audience is wondering, how do they know whether or not they're on the right track with an invention, or if they should even pursue it?
Well, the first thing you have to do is know what your market is. So when I did commercial invention, I was looking for something, but unfortunately, there was really no market to speak of for carbon monoxide detectors. So I had to create the market, and that was a bit bigger challenge. But that was my second company, and I made a lot of money on the first company, so I was able to do it. But it is a very difficult question. First of all, you need funding of some sort, either your own funding or another source of funding. This fellow named Edison, which everybody's heard of, was really good at getting money from J.P. Morgan and other financial backers, So you can get money from, he started General Electric, Menlo Park was just what he started. His greatest invention was the R&D structure. It's actually a division of a company that focuses on R&D, and he had 220 people working for him. So Edison accomplished a lot, but he did so because he had the 240 people in an organization that he put together. That was his greatest invention. The light bulb Well, he didn't actually invent the light bulb. He improved it. Yeah. There was somebody in England, Humphrey Davies, Sir Humphrey Davies, who actually was a physics professor, and he invented the first light bulb, but it didn't last very long. So Edison was able to make one that lasted a long time and then learned how to manufacture it. But not only did he learn how to manufacture it, but he had to build a system in order to put the power in the light bulbs. He had to have a generator, so he built dynamos. He had to have a utility infrastructure. He built that. So he did what, you know, three or four or five companies would do today, because you know, you have utilities that are separate. You have power manufactured by generally a utility, but they buy the equipment from somebody like General Electric or Westinghouse or some other company. Some of the biggest generators, of course, are made by Pratt & Whitney, but GE is probably still the biggest generator company in America. And so you have to understand the market. So the first thing to do, if there is no market, like there was no market for personal computers when Apple came out with one, but they developed the market. So you can't be totally closed. If you have a really good idea and you can see the need and that you can develop the market and you have a strategy and a business plan and you take it to people who think it's worth funding, then you don't have to worry about it. Let the venture capitalists help you. They are there to help for inventions that will change the world and make billions of dollars. They're not interested in making 10 million or 5 million or even 100 million. They want something that's going to make billions. I'm not sure anybody would turn down a $500 million company or a $900 million company, but they want to hit big, like the Apple computer. They want multi-billion dollar company because they're taking high risks and they're looking for big bang bucks at the other end, dominant change in things we do. Somebody funded Apple and, it became a great company, and it still is. Some companies flare out right and get bought out, but you have to look at the market again and determine what the need is and how you can sell it in a business plan that will allow you to, if you have to develop the market, how to do it. So marketing plan is very important in any business plan. That's the most important section that you'll find your venture capitalists will read very carefully. So I think that it's really looking at the market.
So what if you have an invention? What if you have an invention and you got a patent, but you can't afford to do the mold?
Well, I think then you go.
What happens?
What size is the market? Depends on what size it is. There's two ways of getting funding. One is with angels, and they'll look at things that will make $10 million or $100 million. They're typically interested in something $100 million or more, and they'll invest in it. So you have angel. We have something in San Diego called the Captain's Table, and a lot of wealthy people who made money in their businesses and were successful, they go and try to help other people. And they not only give some of their own money, but they also will go on the board and they'll help manage it. So you have those people, a lot of good people here. And in other towns, I'm sure, have the same type of structure and things like that. And so you can go there and if you're an entrepreneur, and you can make presentations. Now, if you're in L.A. or Phoenix or other places, I'm sure they have similar things. One of the groups that was very there's an MIT group that sponsors business plan presentations to financial groups also, and Caltech has one. So a lot of the Stanford, a lot of the top universities have kind of groups that they teach the people a little bit on how to put together a business plan, and then they present their business plan in these groups, and they invite people who want to invest. And a lot of those are angels. Some are VCs, venture capitalists. Venture capitalists are looking for really big markets,
wow.
But your angels, I call them angels, the individual wealthy individuals who can afford to throw down a couple hundred thousand or even sometimes a million without blinking. So I think those are the people you want to reach. If you need money for tooling, or if you need help putting together a marketing plan, those types of things, they will take a big bite. You know, they may want, like Shark Tank, they may want, 51% of your company for the first $1 million. So, or even 500,000, depending on how far along you are, and how well you're protected, and how big the market is. Yeah. They'll look at the patents in the previous literature and those types of things. But, a good venture capitalist is nobody to turn away. If they're interested in you, they are thinking you have a potential $1 billion business. So, but the VCs are not the only ground, and angels are a very good place to start. It's where I started my first company. I got funding for my first company, originally from a small business loan, but that was nothing, $800,000, just enough to do a contract, okay, to manage a contract to build a few prototypes and things. So then later, I got money from some individuals, investors. One of them, Bill Epstein, helped me get started, and he liked airplanes, and I liked airplanes, and we used to go diving together in the Bahamas. It worked out, and he helped me get that company started. Then, when I sold that company, I did a few different things, but I kind of feel that working, I used to be a theoretician, but working in the laboratory was fun, and to make inventions and develop into the products is fun. And if the government's willing to pay for it, you can do it. But if you're going in the commercial markets, then you have to be willing to pay for it or raise money to do it. So I think I spent about $2.5 million R&D funds before I made that carbon monoxide sensor into commercial. And I worked very hard, just like Edison. Edison worked really hard. He knew that other people were working at the same time as he was in England, and there was another one in the United States. And he knew that they were on the track. So he worked very intensely. Sometimes he didn't change his clothes for weeks. One week goes home, didn't give his wife much attention. He slept sometimes in the building in Menlo Park because he was compelled to do the research. But he wasn't really great to the people who worked for him. He had 220 people towards the during the peak times. He was very stubborn and never really wanted to accept AC as the power source. He wanted DC, and AC is called alternating current. DC is direct current. But to transport power, today we use AC. Our homes have 110 AC, and we have plugs and outlets and all that stuff. Of course, he had to build all those things when he started and sell them and put the lighting in. And he did a marvelous job, but he didn't give credit to many of his people, and he got a lot of help. So there was, he had a team. He wasn't working like a single inventor. That's very, very different. He was financially backed and had big money. J.P. Morgan, was a billionaire. Yeah, and he could afford to back Edison. And he did up to a point. But eventually, originally it was Edison, General Electric. But they dropped the Edison when they merged the company. There was another U.S. company where the guy was following him. They had years of litigation between that guy Thompson and Edison. And eventually, J.P. Morgan said, "I'm buying you, Thompson," because he didn't want the lawsuits. So he bought Thompson. He called it General Electric, dropped Edison, because Thompson was a competitor of Edison, and GE is the success it is today. It was a technology company when it started. Yeah. And that's the story.
That is so intriguing, those stories. Yeah, and it's so intriguing, and I wish we wouldn't have run out of time, because you and I have something in common. We both wrote books. We're both poets. And I have an invention, too.
Tell me about it.
There you go.
I'd like to know, like to learn more about it. Head of them.
I would love to tell you about it. But I don't have time on the show because we ran out of time.
Okay. Oh, it's okay. I'm sorry.
I'd definitely like to tell you about
it. It's just,
I
want to wish you.
I'm just totally intrigued with all this information. We'll do it again.
Yeah, I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving tomorrow. Have a happy Thanksgiving to all your listeners.
And your family, a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you so much, and I, just want to thank you so much for all this wonderful information. It's so intriguing. I just love it. And God bless you, and that you have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving with your family, and many, many blessings.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
Good night. And Dr. Mark Kingston Levin has left the building. And I just want to let you know that you can get his book. It's an award-winning book. Part 2 and Part 3 of the trilogy will be coming out in 2018. So you definitely want to watch for it. And again, I want to say God bless you. God bless America. Have a safe, happy, wonderful Thanksgiving with your family and friends. And we'll talk to you next Wednesday at 8 to 9 p.m. when the Rose will have another very special guest.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or, if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.